excited that Roy gave the money, though she would have preferred that the Red Cat Theater be housed in a separate facility. Diane contributed another $25 million from her mother's foundation, and she and her late sister Sharon's children also gave additional gifts. Sharon died of cancer in 1993. Then, after the board retreat, and with Eisner's support, Disney came through with $25 million. Still, it irked Diane that Eisner, who had become so wealthy from Walt's legacy, gave nothing personally. VandeKamp arranged a press conference to announce the Disney corporate grant, and suddenly other corporate coffers opened. Within 6 weeks, she obtained another $45 million in commitments. Suddenly, the new concert hall was a viable project. The following summer, when Eisner called VandeKamp, she had a moment of anxiety that he'd changed his mind and that Disney was canceling the commitment. Instead, she was surprised when he suggested that VandeKamp join the Disney board. "Jane and I were talking," he said. "You'd be a wonderful representative for culture in Los Angeles on the board," he said. "Jane and I think you'd be perfect." VandeKamp was flattered by the suggestion. It didn't occur to her that, as the chairman of an institution that benefited from Disney largesse, she might be seen as anything less than independent. Indeed, she found it jarring when Eisner added, "Of course, don't come back to me for more money if you're on the board." Freed from his preoccupation with Ovitz, his own power now fully consolidated, Eisner showed little or no interest in finding another president. Despite the pleas of his wife and the advice of his doctors, he seemed even less interested in sharing power with a partner. As he indicated in his letter to Ray Watson, his chosen successor within the company was now Bob Iger, someone he barely knew, who had been with the company just over a year, and whom he had freely criticized, even in the letter to Watson when he suggested that he was naming Iger his heir apparent. Conspicuously absent from Eisner's succession planning were both Sandy Litvak, who was continuing to function both as chief operating officer and Eisner's main confidant, and studio head Joe Roth, whose duties had expanded to include both live-action film and the television studios. Litvak had outlasted all of his obvious challengers for the presidency, Katzenberg, Ovitz, Bollenbach. But Eisner resisted naming him president, later testifying that he never considered him a viable candidate. Litvak wasn't physically imposing and lacked the polish that Welles had. Eisner couldn't see him representing Disney to the outside world. Perhaps, as so often happens in corporate suites, serving as Eisner's hatchet man had earned Litvak Eisner's contempt as much as his gratitude. Still, Litvak was generously paid. His options alone were valued at nearly $20 million in Disney's 1997 SEC filing. To outsiders, Roth seemed the most obvious candidate. He was handsome, urbane, and articulate. Just about everyone liked him, both inside Disney and in Hollywood's creative community. In the wake of Ovitz's departure, Eisner and Roth had several conversations about Roth's future at the company and the possibility that he might succeed Ovitz as president. In one of these meetings, Roth nominated himself, volunteering that, "I could be president. I could function as a kind of junior partner. We could be a creative team." But Eisner made clear that he didn't want a real partnership.